taking their place in a long, true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, this is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me today. I have a special guest joining me, a Wallace Garneau. He is a two-service military veteran. That's right. He is both a Marine and a soldier, a member of the U.S. Army. He's got years and years of experience in e-commerce, IT, business systems, and he wrote a very interesting article on America Out Loud that I really want to talk to him about. Wallace, how are you doing today?
I've never been better, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, what's the Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times. Well, times surely are interesting right about now. Your article that really caught my attention is called The End of Human Rights and the Beginning of Tyranny. And in that, you mentioned three very important dates. Can you remind us what those are and why they're important?
Yeah, the first date is the 15th of June, 1215, when the Magna Carta was signed. The concept of human rights didn't really exist prior to that, unless you were the king, in which case your human rights reigned supreme. Nobody else had human rights, only the king, and then the people under the king, you know, his nobility had rights that kind of reached down from him. The next birthday, or the next day important to civil rights was, or human rights, was July 4, 1776, with the Declaration of Independence, which declared for the first time that human rights are inherent, you cannot take them away, or God-given, as the Declaration said, and that the people have the right to overthrow any government that denies them their human rights. The third date is the 10th of December, 1948, when the United Nations declared human rights to be universal and then also kind of expanded human rights away from the negative rights that were included in the Bill of Rights and into positive rights, what some people call positive rights, which is essentially the right for the government to give you things. Or rather, the government is required to give you things such as food, shelter, clothing. The government becomes the provider of those necessities. And anybody who can't get them on their own, the government then has to step in and provide them. And those are important dates because the first two were creating human rights, but they were creating human rights in the sense of what the government cannot do to you. So you have the right to live your life as an individual, however you see fit, to define your self-interests, however you see fit, and to follow those self-interests, however you can, provided you allow others the right to follow their self-interest the same way. Our country was founded upon that, but then when you start introducing positive rights, which are things the government has to do for you, those always come at the expense of human rights because the government obviously doesn't have anything that it doesn't take away from somebody else.
You know, it's interesting. I teach a class called What is a Right? And I think you're one of the few people I've heard refer to negative versus positive rights other than me. You know, I take it a step farther. When I looked up the definition of rights the dictionary, both the Webster's 1828 and I believe the current Merriam-Webster, it came down to a just immunity or privilege. And it's interesting because, like you said, negative rights, it's an immunity from actions of others, right? That's a negative right means you can't do something to me. A positive right is a just claim on someone's action. So when you go through and you were talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and you broke it up into two different groups, you noted that, you know, most of the first group were things that cannot be done to you, things government is not allowed to do to you. But the last eight really were not very good, were they?
No, the last eight are horrendous. The problem with the government being the provider of things or with having rights to things that other people produce is that other people have to produce them. So it is invariably a system geared towards slavery.
Yeah, and I always find it interesting. Most of the people that argue for positive rights only argue from the consumption side, the person receiving the rights. They never consider the supply side or who has to actually provide those rights.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because Karl Marx had the exact same problem. He kind of assumed that he could make any changes to society that he wanted to. And because society had proven itself to be capable of producing at some given level, society would continue to produce at that given level. And as a consequence, the entire concept that if we change the incentive system, it will have an effect on what people do was kind of lost on Marx. And it's also kind of lost, apparently, on the United Nations.
Well, I guess Santayana was true. Those who refuse to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Our history goes back to the Pilgrims tried a socialist system where, you know, everybody worked and everyone was expected to work and nobody was forced to work, but everybody got to take whatever they needed. And for some strange reason, they found there were a lot of people, not everybody, but there were a lot of people who were more than willing to not work, but take food from everyone else. And it wasn't until that was changed that the colony actually became self-sufficient and thrived. It was on the brink of death until they said, hey, you know what? Maybe this, you know, to each according to his own, it doesn't really work.
Well, and it can't work. I mean, when you think about human motivation and just the way we are built as human beings, of course, we're going to pursue our own self-interest. The question really is one of, do we pursue our own self-interest through economic means, which make the pie larger if we're successful? People want to buy our goods and services, and then we make money, and they trade money for something they consider more valuable in terms of those goods and services. Or do we want to pursue our self-interest through political means? Through political means, that means I'm going to petition the government to give me or my group, whatever I identify as, more, which the government would invariably have to take from somebody else. And the thing about economic self-interest is that it produces more, it makes the economy larger and creates more output that can then be distributed. The political self-interest, when you pursue your self-interest through political means, excuse me, that truly is a zero-sum game. So everything that people say they hate about capitalism, what they want to replace it with, has the faults that they claim capitalism has, whereas capitalism doesn't, of course, have those faults.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's the line? Capitalism is the worst form of economics in the world, except for everyone else. you know, it just has worked each and every time. And every time any sort of collectivism has been tried at the national level, it fails. And the problem I think people don't seem to put together is collectivism works at the microscopic level, the small level, right? You have a family. You have, you know, mom, dad, kids, that's a collectivist group. You know, mom and dad work, they do the chores, they do the cleaning, but everyone consumes from that. And that works. And what nobody realizes is that once you start scaling that up, it stops working. And no matter how much history shows that just does not work, we still have people who are, as I believe Einstein was claimed to have said, you know, if you do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, that's the definition of insanity. So I suppose that's a good definition of the Marxists that are running loose in America today.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think you made a very good point. You talked about communism and scale, but I don't know that the scale is so much the issue. Obviously, you can only scale so far, but I don't know that scale is so much the issue as is the question of compulsion. The only communist systems that have ever worked in recorded history were those that people could freely enter and leave. In other words, they occurred in a free market society. If you can get 100 people all to live with you, like David Koresh style or something, maybe without the religious aspect of it, but they all go out, they work, they farm, whatever they do. People work collectively for the collective, and then you share the output of that. As long as people can come and go, and you can throw people out if they're not working hard enough or whatever, that can work. And it has worked historically. It's worked in the United States. But as soon as you make it compulsive, where people have to be in the commune, that's when it starts to really fall apart, because then people don't feel, you know, if there's no threat, they can leave it. And if they're not allowed to leave it, if they want to, then that's when the work ethic starts to break down. And the other thing that's interesting, we look at collectivist systems within the United States. The Bill of Rights gives the states the right to do many things that the federal government cannot do. We look at the Constitution as something that restrains the federal government, lists specifically what the federal government can do. Well, it doesn't list what the state governments can do. The only limitation on state powers is the Bill of Rights. As long as the states don't violate the Bill of Rights, California can run a commie flag as high as it wants to. It just can't violate people's civil rights. But they don't want to do it at the state level, because if California, for example, were to give everybody free health care, they would have to tax the people in California to pay for that. And people would have the ability to move out from underneath it. As a consequence, whenever we see these kinds of systems implemented, they always try to do it at the federal level, even though it's illegal to do it at that level, but legal to do it at the state level. California knows people are going to move to Texas if they're healthy, if they try to make everybody pay for universal health care. And as a consequence, California doesn't want to do it by themselves. They want to force everyone to do it within the country.
a couple of really interesting points. One, it was an excellent explanation that it's not scale, but compulsion, and which brings up something I've said before. If this idea of collectivism is so great, why do you have to force people to participate? That's the question that never seems to get answered. But, it's interesting, and only because, again, this is the Constitution study. I'm a constitutional scholar, so my listeners are going to be expecting to say this. There are actually more restrictions on the states in the Constitution than just the Bill of Rights. But what's interesting is the states delegated rights to the federal government. There are limited powers that actually, the people give to the states, and then the states took some, and they delegated to the federal government. And in many ways, it's the fact that the American people are both ignorant and apathetic. When it comes to the Constitution, they don't know, they don't care. So you're right. The federal government goes about doing things that are nowhere near authorized by the Constitution. They are a blatant violation. But you're right. You have a state like California that says we want to have this collectivist style, if not fully collectivist government. We don't have this collectivist style. We want to hand out all these goodies. But when we can't pay for it, we want someone else. We want the rest of the country to come bail us out, which, again, not only proves that this stuff just doesn't work, but it proves that the states know it can't really work. This can't be a viable way of governing because it's failed everywhere, even within the United States. But there's got to be something else. And to me, the something else always seemed to be the power of the few. In any of these collectivist environments, it's Animal Farm, right? We're all equal, but some of us are more equal than others.
Well, you're aware that Fidel Castro's daughter is a billionaire.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the way that works.
Which is why I always find it interesting when people point out the rich Marxists and say, see, this proves that Marxism, this is exactly what happens in every collectivist society, socialist, Marxist, communist, whatever label Maoist you want to put on it. You always have a few people who have all the power, and they get rich. They get incredibly wealthy while everyone else is poor. So when we see those, that is not the exception to the rule. That is the rule. It is not everybody shares. It's everybody shares, but this small group gets a boatload more.
Well, yes, it is. And who the small group is pretty easy to spot. One of the things that makes everybody ask, why do the intelligentsia always want communism or socialism or some form of collectivist system? And the answer to that really is fairly simple. In a free market, such as the United States, an entrepreneur is the one who makes all the money. You produce a good or a service that other people want. They buy that good or a service. And if that good or service happens to be an iPhone or the Microsoft operating system, you make a lot of money. What the intelligentsia do is they look at that and they say, wait a minute. We're the top of society. We should be the ones in charge. We should be the ones that get all the spoils. Why is it that Bill Gates is getting the spoils and not me, Mr. College Professor, or me, Mrs. Hillary Clinton, or somebody else who considers themselves a part of that moral and intellectual elite? They believe that a system that gives entrepreneurs the power and the wealth, rather than giving it to the intelligentsia, is invariably corrupt, and as a consequence, they want to tear that down and replace it with a system in which they get the spoils.
Yeah, it's a true aristocracy. It's, unless you go to the right school, unless you do the right things, join the right clubs, you're not considered highborn enough to warrant these special favors. And you're right, a collectivist society always has a ruling class. And that ruling class always lives very, very well at the expense of everyone else, which always, to me, begs the question why so many people in the non-ruling class are begging for this. Is it truly just the narcissism of I want, the greed of seeing what someone else has and desiring it regardless of whether or not you've worked for it? Or is it just the laziness of, I want to sit back, eat Cheetos, play video games, and expect someone else to take care of me?
I think there are two primary motivations behind it. I think for some people, it's envy. And I think that that is one of the big things that they teach, be envious of those who have more, such as when Stalin went into the Ukraine and told the Ukrainian farmers that the people who owned their lands, the kulaks, as they called them, were stealing from the rest of the farmers who did not own their lands. The kulaks were the ones, of course, who were the most successful and the most efficient farmers out there. And so they killed off all the kulaks, and then the rest of the Ukrainians, millions and millions of them starved to death because they didn't have any food. So yeah, envy is certainly a big, big part of it. But I think the other part of it is that they make people who are successful feel that somehow that success is bad, that they're a bad person for having been successful, and that they need to then support this system that gives to those who are not successful. And of course, we want to be generous with those who are not successful. The real question is, and you'll never hear a communist frame it this way, but the real question is, who has the primary responsibility for supporting themselves? Is it the individual or is it society? Now, you can say that we want a society where the individual is primarily responsible for supporting themselves, but that we want to be able to help those who, for whatever reason, not due to their own fault, but for whatever reason, are unable to fully do it. And then you'd have them support themselves to the degree that they can, and the government might step in and help out a little bit at the end. But if you flip it around completely and say that the government needs to be the basis of support for the people, that's when the wheels fall off the bus. And of course, that's what they're pushing for.
Yeah. And, you know, the one size fits all of any government program ends up being more detrimental to the person they're trying to help than the help they're receiving, because it doesn't fit. You know, it doesn't take into consideration that person's actual situation, maybe their medical situation, their education situation, their emotional situation. It simply says, oh, you're a person here, let me throw money at you, and their, you know, life will be fine. So yeah, it never works. And it's frustrating to hear people keep bringing the same things up, saying, well, this, it'll work right this time. Why?
Yeah, but they don't bring up the same things. I mean, one of the things which is fascinating about looking at communism through history, really any political system through history, they don't necessarily learn from the fundamental mistakes, but they learn from the little mistakes. So, for example, Stalin had his NKVD, I think it was called, the security police, the secret police. Mao didn't do that. What Mao did instead is he said, well, let's defund the police and utilize community policing, and got large portions of China to agree with that. They got rid of their police. They used community policing. Well, the community police turned into his Red Army. They were his followers. It became the community police. And, you know, you see elements not only of Soviet-style socialism or Soviet-style communism in the things that you're seeing, the rhetoric and the things people are working on in the United States, but you also see a lot of stuff that is more Trotskyist or Maoist. And those things, you know, what they're doing is they're kind of taking the greatest hits, trying to learn from past mistakes. But they're trying to learn from past mistakes in terms of how can we implement this without having to kill 100 million people? Maybe we only kill 10 million. They're not looking at it in terms of fundamental flaws and whether or not the system can work at all. Somehow that lesson never gets learned.
Yeah, what I refer to as rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's going down, but you're worried about the wrong things. Let's talk a little bit. I want to talk a little bit more about the positive rights, because you made an interesting point in the article that by providing positive rights to the public requires labor, putting the government in a position where it will be required to take labor by force.
Well, taxation is, of course, taking labor by force. If you don't pay your taxes, you can go to jail. So any form of taxation is taking labor by force. And I'm not necessarily against all taxation. I'm not going to say, you know, taxation is evil. I do believe that there are legitimate things government does, and that the government has a right and a necessity to support itself in doing those things. But when you talk about government as the supplier of things, now, it always ends up with a country like Venezuela, where what happens is you have changed the incentive system where it's no longer incentivized to produce. People choose not to. Corporations can't make a profit, so they stop producing. And eventually the goods and services that are necessary to feed and support a people are no longer out there. And then you can use price controls to try to keep things affordable, but that doesn't really help when you walk into a grocery store and there's nothing on the shelves, which is what Venezuela, of course, is finding itself in. Once that happens, the leader of the country only has a few choices. One is to say, well, that didn't work. I guess maybe we should go back to something more akin to a free market. But being ideologues, they don't choose that. The other option is to round the people up against their will and send them out of the farms and into the factories where they will produce the things that the public needs to survive against their will. And at that point, you've got Soviet-style communism. And I think that's what Venezuela is going to choose. They'll choose it from a sense of necessity. What I wish people understood is that Bernie Sanders might be the nicest guy in the world, but if he lives long enough as leader of a country and he implements the policies he wants to implement, once the people are starving in the streets, the nicest guy in the world is going to choose communism in order to force people to work so that he can feed them. And he's going to justify it by saying, well, I'm not forcing everyone to work. I'm only forcing those greedy bastards who weren't willing to work without pay to work.
Yeah. And you know, like I said, no matter what your good intentions, eventually reality slaps you in the face and you have to do something. And you end up backing yourself into this corner of, well, my only choice is to rule with an iron fist. I've eliminated everything else as a possibility because I refuse to believe that, you know, maybe I was wrong. And, you know, it all sounds good and great until people start getting lined up and carted off somewhere.
And look at the justifications they give. You know, Bernie Sanders has actually said, not just Bernie Sanders, Maduro in Venezuela himself has said that the reason Venezuela is struggling is not because of socialism. It's because those dirty capitalists won't feed it. They won't produce the things necessary to support the people. So it's capitalism's fault that socialism doesn't work. And I look at that and I say, now, wait a minute here. Socialism is supposed to be a replacement for capitalism. You can't say that socialism would work great if capitalism would feed it, because if socialism worked, it wouldn't need capitalism to feed it. The idea that one system is going to replace the other but still be fed by it should sound absurd in its face. And yet people say that with a straight face, and I don't hear people calling them out.
What I find most interesting is everybody seems to be for socialism, it works until it's actually applied to them. And I can't remember where I heard this story. There was a gentleman, there was kind of this round table discussion amongst a group. And, you know, you had the diehard capitalist and the diehard socialist and everybody in between. And, you know, the capitalist was speaking and one of the socialists was saying, well, you know, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. You know, you have a right to live. You have a right to all this. When the capitalist sat down, the socialist got up to speak. The capitalist reached over, grabbed the purse of the socialist and started rifling through it. And she was like, well, what are you doing? I said, well, if everything you own belongs to everybody else, I have just as much a right to scrounge through your pocketbook and decide what I would be. It'd be better for me to have it than you. Than anybody else. This is the logical outcome of your discussion. And they're kind of left flat-footed. We see the exact same thing when, as you say, Bernie Sanders, the man who said you don't need 27 different brands of deodorant, you know, you don't need that. You shouldn't be allowed to do that. You shouldn't be allowed to manufacture something and sell it, has become a millionaire by producing a book and selling it.
Ironically, a book about socialism.
Yeah. Which
I mean, think about that. He makes money selling a book on socialism.
Yeah. And you know, if the hypocrisy weren't so painful, it'd be humorous. I mean, this should be a Saturday Night Live skit. It should be a parody of reality. But yet it's accepted so much today that, you know, oh, well, no, this is true. This is what happens. But as soon as you take a college student who is, you know, Marxist, socialist, you know, kill the rich, take all their money. Okay, hand over your iPhone. They go berserk.
Phil Donahue once asked Milton Friedman if he thinks that greed is really a good thing to run an economy on it or to run a country on. And Milton Friedman's response was brilliant. Instead of answering the question directly, he kind of dissected the question itself and asked and focused on the premises behind it. And he said, well, what is greed? Now, who's greedy? Are you greedy? Am I greedy? And Milton Friedman said, none of us are greedy. Just ask us. It's always the other guy who's greedy. And what I think happens is somebody like Bernie Sanders writes a book and he puts an effort to write the book and then the book sells. And he says, I've earned this money because I wrote the book and the book is popular because I must be a good writer. And so they justify their own wealth based upon the effort they put forth to get it. But then they downplay the fact that the effort of a lot of other people went into their wealth. And as a consequence, you know, it's they don't even see yet they're being hypocrites because they see their own work, but they don't see the work of other people. And they assume if they don't see it, it didn't happen. And that's particularly true in the case of like Steve Jobs, who had all of the ideas behind Apple's products, but wasn't on the plant floor manufacturing those products. Somehow he doesn't seem to think that ideas are valuable unless they're his ideas.
Yeah, it's amazing. The blindness we all have, you know, the thinking that history began when, you know, when our lives began, that nothing before really matters. We never see the work, you know, we see the things we want to see in other people, but we never see what got them there. You know, like I said, everybody complains, you know, Bezos, Zuckerberg, all of them, look at how much money they have. No one ever goes back and looks and says, but wait a second, they started out poor. And what did they do? They provided something that other people valued. And that's how they got rich, which is the wonderful thing about a free market, which we don't really have in this country, but a freer market is you are most successful when you are serving your fellow citizen, not when you're taking from your fellow citizen.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. A free market is of course, the other thing I wish people understood is that if you don't have free markets, you can't have free people. People look at an economy like it's some kind of an engine or something that you use to drive a car and you can steer it and steer the car or whatever. But really, all the economy is the daily activities of all of the people who live within a given country or a given society. If you control the economy, you're controlling the everyday activities of those people. And as a consequence, you cannot control an economy without controlling the people. Socialism is and will always be about controlling the people.
And interestingly enough, everywhere it's tried, the people always find a way around the system. I mean, the black market, at least I'm old enough to have lived through the Cold War. I'm old enough to have known the Soviet Union and seen the aspects of it. And the thing I always found interesting is the Soviet Union was known as much for its black market as it was for its communism. But the other thing I always found most amazing is when someone would immigrate from the Soviet Union to the United States. I used to live in New York City, so I would meet these people, and they were dumbfounded to see a grocery store. Something we take for granted. We get all bent out of shape when we can't get exactly what we want at the grocery store when we want it. These people walked in and said the very idea of that much food being readily available for purchase it's like you'd open the pearly gates and they'd walked into heaven.
Have you heard the story about Boris Yeltsin breaking down to tears in the grocery store?
I have, but tell my audience about it. It's a great story.
Yeah, it's a great story. Boris Yeltsin was not yet the president of Russia. He was on Gorbachev's Politburo. And he flew into the United States and he had his entourage. He said, you know, just pull off here. I want to get off the highway. So he picked the exit. They got off the highway and he had him drive around and find a grocery store. And so he picked the grocery store. He wanted to pick it himself because he didn't want it to be, you know, set up. So nobody had any idea he was going to do any of this. So they get out and they go to the grocery store and he's asking people questions. You know, is every store have this quantity of food? And is it this easy to get? And everybody's like, oh, yeah, you know, you come in, you get what you want, and you pay for it. And then you go home and you have your food. And Gorbachev broke down in tears and said, everything I have been taught my entire life is a lie. In Russia, people wait for food. In America, food waits for people. And brilliant statement that he made. And, you know, I give the guy a lot of credit. Most people would have come in there and would have tried to find a way to justify grocery stores not being good. Maybe they'd focus on waste or something. But Boris Yeltsin came in. He saw a grocery store, picked it out himself, and broke down in tears with a sudden knowledge that everything he had been taught, everything he had taught, and everything that he had worked for his entire life was a lie. And then, he unfortunately, didn't live long enough, but he tried to restructure the Russian economy more like ours.
Wallace, this has been great. Thank you for coming on. Please tell my audience where they can find your material and find out more about you.
You can find me at America Out Loud. You can also find me on globallibertymedia.com. You can also find me on my personal blog, which is thedailylibertarian.com. And you can look for my book on Amazon or wherever books are sold. It's called The Way Forward, Lean Leadership and Systems Thinking for Large and Small Businesses. I'm sorry, I didn't look that up. My publisher helped with the title. But you can look for me any of those places, and it was good being on. Thank you.
Thank you, Wallace. Thank you, everyday Americans, for spending some of this time. Before I head off to break, though, I do want to remind you to please check out healthysell.com/outloud. You'll get 20% off your first order. If we're talking about keeping our society and our economy healthy, well, you also want to keep your body healthy as well. Again, check it out at healthysell.com/outloud, and I'll be back after this short break.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. Are you tired of your tired vitamins? Consider Healthy Cell. These are pill-free vitamins that are in convenient gel packs I like the Focus and Recall supplement. I use this a lot. You know, your brain uses a lot of energy and it depends on a variety of micronutrients and vitamins. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cells Focus and Recall vitamins. So go to HealthyCell.com, use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any Healthy Cell product. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
AmericaOutloud.com is the alternative from the agenda-driven globalist. Here, we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. On-demand podcast or real-time talk radio with our streaming apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, Everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. If you missed the first half, you missed a very interesting episode, a discussion with Wallace Garneau, talking about the human rights and the beginning of tyranny in America. And I'll put a link to the article that we were discussing in the description when it hits the website. But after that discussion, talking about things like, you know, human rights and different forms of collectivism and really coming down to that area of compulsion. I think of all the discussions, everything we talked about in that first half hour, this idea of compulsion really resonates with what's been going on lately. You know, I asked the question, if the vaccine is so great, why do we have to compel people to take it? If it's that great, why don't people take it? And that kind of got me thinking, and that kind of got me just pondering this idea. And as I'm looking through some of the news articles I have here, I noticed several things. I noticed, compulsion. For example, most of you probably know by now that the courts found that the CDC eviction moratorium was unconstitutional. A lot of people have claimed the Supreme Court found that. The Supreme Court did not find that. The Supreme Court merely decided it would not vacate a lower court's order. The one opinion in concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh didn't say it was unconstitutional. It said it was illegal. It violated statutory law. It was not a statutory power given to the CDC. Not that the United States has the constitutional power to do it. In fact, he went so far as to say that Congress could do this, which wouldn't be true if it was unconstitutional. But sure enough, you know, Biden turned around and said, well, we're going to extend the moratorium even though the court said it's unconstitutional. And there have been, howls and screams and crazy, oh my God, it's anarchy. How dare he deny the Supreme Court of the United States? Well, the president doesn't work for the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States has no authority over him, so I wasn't really surprised when he reinstated it. But now we have landlords and real estate companies, they are going back to the courts begging for relief from this particular tyrant. Now, don't get me wrong. The CDC eviction moratorium is unconstitutional. It deprives the landlords of the control of their property without due process of law. Fifth Amendment violation, you know, should be a clean-cut case. Nothing is clean-cut anymore. That doesn't mean that simply because our rulers in black robes decide so that, you know, we must all genuflect, the Constitution says so. So here we have the National Association of Realtors, along with the Alabama and Georgia Associations of Realtors. They filed an emergency motion with the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia to enforce, and I love the way this article says, to enforce the Supreme Court recent order. The Supreme Court didn't issue an order. They simply decided not to rescind the district court's order. So, I mean, this, I'm sometimes amazed by what passes for journalism, what passes for an educational discussion. But let me get back to my point. I'm kind of meandering a little bit here. So the CDC issues this order. It is blatantly unconstitutional. The courts say you don't have the statutory power to do this. It is, you can't legally do this, but we're not going to do anything about it because it's going to expire soon. And as soon as it expires, the Biden administration simply reinstitutes it as if it's not the fact that it is not legal doesn't really matter to them. This is what they want. And now the very same, many of the same actors who went to the courts in the first place are now asking the courts again to do what they've already done and Biden is ignoring. See, this is why I talk about compulsion. It's not good enough to say, you know what, we're in a tough strait. You know, what can we do to help people who may have lost their jobs because the states have basically destroyed their jobs? No, we're going to compel people to certain action. They're going to force people to give up their property, the control of their property, income on their property, because we think it's the right thing to do. And the fact that the courts don't agree with me, the fact that Congress never gave them the authority to do that, the fact that the Constitution never gave the United States the authority to do that, that doesn't matter. We're going to compel people to act in the way we want. This is why I say you cannot trust courts for your liberty because, as Alexander Hamilton said, they have neither force nor will, only judgment. The courts can't force the president to do anything. And that goes all the way back to Marbury versus Madison. That was a primary question behind the opinion of Marbury versus Madison. Did the court have the legal authority to order the executive branch to do something? But we're talking again about compulsion. See, we call ourselves the land of the free. How can you be free if you can be compelled to do things like this? Now, whether you think a landlord should or should not have forgiven or postponed or taken some action for the renter, that's their property. How would you react if President Biden suddenly came along and said, listen, that home you own, no, it's not yours anymore. We're going to tell you what you can do with it. And we don't think, you know, you got a pretty big home. We don't think only one family should live there. We think you need to take in two or three families. Isn't that compulsion? Is that really that different from what President Biden and his administration is doing now? They're saying we don't think it's right for you to kick somebody out because we've destroyed the economy. And they don't have a job, so we're not going to let you do with your property what you want. This is the antithesis of liberty and justice for all. This is not liberty, and this is not justice. This is tyranny. This is bold-faced, in-your-face tyranny. And for those realtors and for those landlords who are waiting for the courts and begging the courts to give them their freedom back, I have a suggestion. Go to the courts. I have no problem with you going to the courts. No, what you need to do is you need to find out if your sheriff believes in his oath or her oath to the Constitution. See, the Constitution says you cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And there's been no due process here. Due process is not, you know, something that the government does. It is a process that protects the rights of the individual. Not my words, the words from the Free Legal Dictionary. So rather than hoping and praying that not only will a federal court agree again with you that what's being done is unconstitutional or that it's wrong, but that the president actually listen to them, how about you go to your sheriff, who's the chief law enforcement officer in your county, make sure that they recognize the Constitution and that they enforce it as the supreme law of the land. Just because it comes out of Washington doesn't make it supreme. This is the understanding. This is why understanding the idea of compulsion and the idea that you do not have to submit to compulsion is so important. You see, we all assume that just because Biden said so, this must be in effect until the courts say otherwise. But that's not what the Constitution says, and that's not what our founding fathers created. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Papers number 78 said, "There is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void." Now, if President Biden is issuing an order or telling his CDC, and yes, the entire executive agency works for the president, if he's telling him to do something that is contrary to his commission as president of the United States, in other words, he has not been delegated that authority, then that act is void. It's about time we start making sure our sheriffs look at this and saying, sorry, I can't do that. That's a violation of the Constitution. If someone orders, if I get an eviction notice from a landlord, I am honor bound, I am duty bound, I am bound by my oath to support the Constitution to do so, because this order from the CDC is not valid. It is void. It is contrary to the Constitution. It is contrary to the tenor of the commission under which President Biden and the entire executive branch serves. See, the answer to compulsion is not hoping someone else will protect you. It's learning how to protect yourself. Because I'm here to tell you, this is not the end of compulsion. This is merely the beginning. I found this article. This came off of Fox News, and it's kind of one of those, they didn't say no, right? They're claiming that the White House did not deny a report that the Biden administration is considering leveraging federal funds muscle to push institutions to require Americans to get vaccinated. A White House official said, "As we always are, the administration is discussing a host of different measures we can continue to boost vaccination across the country. Any reported ideas under consideration are in early conversations and pre-decisional. There are no imminent policy decisions as to preview at this time." Now, understand what's starting off here. The administration is trying to compel you. They're trying to force you to get a vaccine. They've tried to coerce you through goodies, and now they're looking at other things and possibly even using extortion to get institutions to require you to get vaccinated. So your school, your college, your university, your business, corporations, stores, movie theaters, you name it, the federal government may, they haven't said they will, they may, or maybe better way to put it is they haven't denied that they would. So it's, you know, I'm not making any accusations yet. But would anybody really be surprised that the federal government wouldn't turn around to these organizations and say, listen, if you don't require vaccines, we're going to cut off the federal money. See, this is what comes from federal bribery. I've been warning about this for years. When you accept federal money, when you accept any government money, it comes with strings. Now you have businesses and organizations that have become dependent on this federal money, which means if you don't do what the government wants, they simply cut off the spigot. Now, is it extortion? Yes. Are you open to that extortion? Yes, because you've accepted the bribe. So before you go, oh, these little institutions that the big bad federal government's going to bully, remember, they're in this situation because they accepted a bribe. In effect, I mean, you can't blackmail somebody unless they've got something to be blackmailed about. And basically what the federal government is doing, saying, listen, you've accepted our money, you've accepted our bribes, now do what we say or else. And again, they haven't said this. This is not an active program. It not in this particular case. It's been used everywhere, though. How many times with the whether it's Obama and the Department of Education, the Dear Colleague letter, or President pretty much every president I can think of has used federal money to influence and persuade states and other organizations. Heck, they do it to you all the time. Why do you think the Internal Revenue Code is so bloody large? The Internal Revenue Code has nothing to do with collecting taxes. It's about using the power of taxation to persuade you, to force you, to leverage you into actions those in Washington, D.C. want. So I actually would be surprised if the White House does not at some point turn around and threaten federal funds for different organizations or institutions that fail to buckle under to a tyrant's boot. And that's exactly what this would be if this proposed idea, which may be on the table, actually comes to pass. Again, are we the land of the free when an administration run by a single person can extort you or extort businesses into actions they desire? This is not a free country. And the fact that, you know, it happens to be this particular president that's exercising it is not the problem. The very idea that we've gotten to a point where a president can use the federal funding mechanism to be the bully, to be the tyrant. That the fact that we're even there, whether or not a president actually uses it, the very idea that you would consider, that someone might consider, hey, the federal government is going to extort institutions to toe the line, that should bother every freedom-loving American. How can you have freedom if the federal government, if the opinion of one man can be used to bully you into compliance? Today it's vaccines. What is it tomorrow? What is it a week from now? You know, a lot of this started with you can actually trace a lot of this back to the Patriot Act, again, signed by George W. Bush, and the idea that we would give up our right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures because we were afraid that there'd be another terrorist attack. Now, those very same mechanisms are used to target the political enemies of certain individuals. When we turned over, when the states allowed themselves to become subjects of the federal government in the aspects of Medicaid, Medicare, welfare, well, then all we did was they've given government this power. Not because they haven't actually given to it. They simply let the government exercise it and never stand up and challenge it. See, the federal government's a bully. That's nothing new. Government as a whole, is a bully. That's how governments work. They bully people into compliance. And hopefully most of us should have learned when we were children that the best way to deal with a bully is not to simply comply, but to stand up. But you see, because we have become so universally ignorant in our rights and our understandings and our Constitution, we don't know that we can stand up. We don't know that our sheriffs are not bound to enforce federal law. They're not bound to enforce any law that violates the Constitution. They're only bound to enforce laws that are compliant with the Constitution. But you see, we don't know that, so we don't know to demand that of them. Therefore, our homes and our businesses are under threat because all the defensive mechanisms that our founders have put in place, all the checks and balances that our founders have put in place, we are failing to use. We're not doing anything with them. it's like having a loaded gun and then locking it away in the safe while you're beaten up. We have the tools, we just refuse to use them. And no, I'm not saying we need to go to guns to do this. We need to understand our rights. We need to understand all the checks and balances. Now, I'm going to be speaking this weekend at Midwest Freedom Fest in Minocqua Grove, North Dakota. Lovely Minocqua Grove. If you're in the area, please come join me. I have a couple of topics I'm talking about. I'm talking about knowing your rights, but I'm also doing a whole session on understanding checks and balances. You know, we were all taught three co-equal branches of government, checks and balances. They'll protect us from each other. As Paul Harvey say, what's about the rest of the story? There is a lot more to these checks and balances to prevent this bullying from Washington. It's not simply, well, we got to get the courts to tell the president no. We got to get Congress to tell the president no. You need to get your state to tell the president no. You need to get your sheriff to tell the president no. And they have the legal authority to do that. And anyone that tells you that the Supremacy Clause requires state and local officials to enforce illegal laws hasn't read the Supremacy Clause. See, it says only laws of the United States made pursuant to the Constitution are the supreme law of the land. Since this is not pursuant to the Constitution, it is not the supreme law of the land, therefore they're not bound to enforce it. It is, as Alexander Hamilton said, and by the way, the Supreme Court of the United States has said, void. And it's that knowledge that makes all the difference in the world. So when I read this particular article, this came out of the Daily Caller, and it says that the U.S. financial regulatory agencies have approved a rule that forces publicly traded companies to reveal the diversity of their executive boardroom to investors. Okay. First of all, the federal government has no legal authority to compel speech. None. Right. Congress cannot make a law that authorizes the federal government in any form to compel speech. Yes, these are publicly traded companies. That doesn't make them public companies. They are still owned by their shareholders. If anyone is going to compel these companies to reveal the diversity of their executive boardroom, it's the investors. It's the owners of the company. But wait, there's more. You see, this rule from the Security and Exchange Commission was actually proposed by NASDAQ. Now, NASDAQ is simply it's a stock exchange. It's where these companies list themselves to be traded. And the rule that was proposed also requires companies to hire at least one female director and one either minority or LGBTQ, LMNOP director to their board. I have a message for each and every company traded on the NASDAQ. When it comes to this rule, tell the federal government, no, you have no legal authority to compel us to speak. You have no legal authority to tell us who we must and must not have on our boards. We are private companies. If our owners, if our stockholders, if our investors want this, they can tell us, but the federal government cannot. And if the answer is the NASDAQ will delist you, I'd be looking for someplace else to go. I don't care if you have females or LMNOPQRST, whatever, on your board. That's not the point. I don't care if you want them on the board. I don't care if you don't want them on the board. The point is simple. The federal government doesn't own you simply because you trade your stocks publicly. The very idea that the federal government can tell you how to run your business means you voluntarily give up being a private organization. You're basically, if you comply because the federal government says so, you have voluntarily said, we're not a private company anymore. We are now subjects of the federal government. and you should be required to tell each and every one of your stockholders, you don't own us anymore. The federal government does. We won't do what you say. We're going to do what the federal government says. See, this is compulsion. And I know a lot of people are going, yeah, but these are big companies, and Paul, they need to be made to do this. If you want to make a company do this, buy a share of stock, go to a stock meeting, and make the proposal yourself. No, you want to have the federal government act as a bully. You want the federal government to break the law to be a bully because you can't be bothered to actually do it yourself. See, that's the big problem. And this, by the way, is why I say a pox on both their houses, because both Republicans and Democrats do the same thing. They cry liberty. They cry freedom. They cry rights until somebody does something they don't like. Then they're more than willing to use force to get it to happen. They're more than willing to engage the bully in Washington, D.C. to get what they want. That's why I say a pox on both of their houses. If you don't think that companies should have women on the board, listen, I have no problem. I don't care if they have women on the board or not. I want them to hire the best people for the board. I want the best people on the board of directors. If that's a woman, if that's half women, if that's all women, if that's black, if that's Hispanic, if that's Asian, if that's Eskimo, I don't care. But the day we let the federal government tell us how to run our business is the day it's no longer our business. And we've let it happen for decades because we were afraid of the bully in Washington, D.C. Benjamin Franklin was right. We must all hang together, or we will assuredly all hang separately. And we are hanging separately now because we would not hang together when this started. And rather than dealing with these illegal actions when they were small, we liked what was being done, so we let it happen. And we became the bully. That's right. America is populated with bribe takers and bullies. Because in order to get what we want, we're more than willing to bully other people into compliance. So when you look at your children and your grandchildren and your nieces and nephews, and you tell them about the good old days of freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of religion and being able to run your own company and do things the way you want, to control your land, to control your business, remind them, you gave it up. Remember, you are the one who took the bribe. You're the one that called in the bully. You are at fault. You can find out more about my show and get all the latest podcasts. Just go to AmericaOutloud.com, look under our shows, and you'll find the Constitution Study.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.